Welcome to the next episode of Flentco Talks. It's your boy Dano. I'm on the road for this episode. We're in Denver on the 22nd floor of the HKS office building. I'm joined here by some of my friends, Mr. Ed Smith, Miss Mackenzie McHale, and Mr. Mark Montgomery. Good afternoon. How are y'all?
Doing great.
Doing great. Mark, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you with? Why are you here today?
Yeah, I'm with WSP. We're an engineering firm here to talk about target value design.
Ooh. Mackenzie?
Mackenzie McHale. I'm with HKS. We are a global architecture firm. And we're here to talk about the same thing Mark's here to talk about.
Brother Ed?
All right. So good to be here with you, Dan, and Mark and Mackenzie. So Ed Smith, director with Flentco, and in my role, I'm involved with the various earliest stages of the project. Love working with owners and design teams. And personally and professionally, I'm really very passionate about TVD or target value design and pre-construction. Happy to talk about it with everybody today.
Awesome. Well, we've got a great group here today. We've got a lot of great minds, great partners that Flentco's worked with before, and we're excited to be able to talk to you all a little bit about TVD. So when we say TVD, everybody kind of has a different way to define it. Mark, do you want to start? When you hear TVD, what goes through your mind?
Yeah, talked about this a little bit earlier today. Target value design or target value delivery, and I like calling it delivery because it's more than just design. It's all-encompassing. You need a really engaged partners, owner, contractor partners, sub-trade partners to really make it effective. I think the way I would just define it would be it's just breaking down a project into different buckets that are managed by the different people and their experts of those disciplines, and then being able to effectively drive the budget based on those buckets, and then being able to when we need to trade money through those buckets to keep the project on target. And in the end, it's delivering the most optimized for the budget for the owner.
Great explanation. Mackenzie, what do you think about when you hear that?
I like it.
TVD acronym.
I like everything you said. I would add that, and we usually say design because, of course, I'm representing the design architecture and interior design, and I think that's always on our mind. I like delivery because I think that's absolutely necessary to focus on. Mm-hmm. But I think the way we talk about it, my definition would be ensuring that the owner's vision is met with a very prescriptive way of defining the scope so that nothing can be lost. And making sure, of course, that the most important thing is that it comes in at budget.
Mm-hmm. Ed, you're next.
Completely in sync with both of those, but it, being a consummate tinker, I always add a little bit to it. So I say target value design and pre-construction. I think the pre-construction is just a critical component of it to make sure we hit the targets. But the approach is just exactly what Mackenzie and Mark said. And I like to work from the outside in, from the general to more specific, to break down a project into its major elements and then take it a little deeper and deeper so that we set small targets that we can hit, that we can manage together.
So when you're on a project team, we'll go back around the circle and we'll start with you, Ed, this time. Like, how often do you utilize TVD on your projects here at Flentco?
Almost every project within Flentco, and the ones that I'm involved in, all of them. I tend to be involved in larger, more complex projects, and it really screams for this type of delivery, for a team to come together and use a collaborative, iterative process to make sure that we do hit our marks.
So before we jump around and get their answers as well, why do you say larger, more complex projects? Why is that better value for those type projects?
I think it's important for all projects, but the larger, more complex projects tend to have a lot of moving parts to it, a lot of places where things can go bad, and using target value approach or delivery allows us to set really reasonable targets, define targets, and to work together to hit them. On smaller projects, do the same thing, but they tend to be not as complex, not as many elements to it.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I would agree. I think it has to be scalable. I think you have to be doing it every time. I think the benefit to our owners is to remove the necessity for value engineering, which is never a successful project. So if you can head that off with the intent of controlling the budget through target value and target values, I think that's really what we're going for. Mm-hmm. And it has to be scalable. I think we do all types of projects, but whether it's called target value design in the RFP, whether we're tasked with that, I think that the mentality is there in everything we do.
Mark, you're nodding your head. Tell me what's on your mind.
Yeah, I think I would say that all of our major projects, and major, I mean, you know, scale, all of our complex projects, and we focus on healthcare, science and technology, and commercial mixed use type projects. And so almost all of our major projects are going TVD, and you know, value engineering is a dirty word. You know, it doesn't add value. Nope. And it's not engineering. So it's waste is what it is. And, you know, when we're really trying to drive our industry and drive waste out of our industry, that's a good place to really focus. Is time is wasted, money's wasted. And then I think in the end, TVD type of delivery is really maximizing that program and making sure that we're having those conversations in a roadmap to tell the story on how we got to what we got to in the end. And I think the benefit to the owner is that they know that they are spending their money where they want their money spent. Mm-hmm. I'm sure all of us have had projects that we've worked on where you're like, they spent money on that, but we VE'd this, right. You know, that kind of stuff. And I've had those experiences where an owner was really upset at the end of a project when they had to value engineer out one of their major programmatic elements, and then in the end got the amount of money back on the contract. Ooh. That they could have put that into the project. That's a major miss. You know, that's a failure at every level. And so this TVD approach is trying to drive that out, and so that we know when we're making those decisions in real time that we're making them in the right direction for what the owner wants in the end.
So many good talking points there, Mark. I really appreciate what you brought to the table. What I'm hearing is like stewardship, right? When you think of the word stewardship, when you think of
great word.
I think of my dad like giving me $20 and telling me like, hey, you have to use this for the week and be a good steward of the money that I'm blessing you with. And how do I take care of it to get through the week and make sure that I can buy my lunch and have money to put in the offering plate on Sunday and take my girlfriend to the movies? Okay, maybe it'd be like $50 in today's time. But so I wanted to go back and let's talk about your process of engagement for you, Mackenzie. Like when y'all are starting on a project and you said, hey, we're definitely doing TVD on here, what's the first things that come to your mind and how you get your team ready?
It's all about relationships and it's all about alignment. Mm-hmm. No matter the team, and I think whether you're talking about HKS's design team internally or the AEC team, you know, globally, I think you have to somehow establish a relationship if it's not there already. And usually it is. Usually the partners you select are for a reason. It's because you have this trust, this foundation that you'll build this project on. It's about trust and knowing that everyone has a voice. And you mentioned as you look granularly at each of the buckets, that you've got the right experts leading those discussions and making sure that the thought leadership is there to really challenge the process and to really be critical thinking throughout the entire process. And to be able to do that successfully from the very beginning all the way through construction, you've got to start with some kind of alignment, conversations, collaboration, discussions, team gatherings, mm-hmm. you know, in-person meetings, those kinds of things, to discuss everyone's role and make sure that everyone's got buy-in.
I love what you said about everybody has a voice. I feel like sometimes the best ideas come from the least likely people in the room, and by allowing somebody to be able to speak up, really can change the way the project's going to go or the design's going to go. Mark, for you, what do you think about when you're saying, hey, we're getting teed up on a TVD job? And I know that Mackenzie probably hit some of yours, but what are other things you think of?
Yeah, some of the things I think of are when are we going to bring in the trade partners and at what stage and who are they going to be? I think, this business always has been and always will be about relationships. Mm-hmm. And so you've got a kind of short list of people in your mind that you're like, hey, I want to make sure that these people are on the invite list to be in the conversation on this project because I trust them and I know that they're going to have my back when we get into the trenches together. So. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Ed, I see you nodding your head over there. What are you thinking?
Well, they're both right on target. And you mentioned Mackenzie in person. I like the first meeting to be in person. We've gotten very good at holding virtual meetings and being very efficient that way, but there's nothing like being in a room face to face. It allows you to draw out more information, draw someone out that might not be willing to speak out or just not comfortable with it, to make sure that we're hearing everything, that we have people that are being transparent, their voices heard, and begin to set not only the targets, the values themselves, but the overall goals for the project so that they're very well defined and we all agree upon them. No silent disagreement, right? And that's where being in the room the first time I think is very important. Working virtually after that some works very well, but that first meeting and then charrettes that we use after that, nothing like being in person in a room together.
When you think about being in person, I heard you say we've gotten very good at Zoom meetings. If you look at my calendar today, it's probably 17 Zoom meetings this week.
Right. Yeah.
It's like I can't agree more with getting the right people in the room. I think about a design build project that I did during the height of COVID, and we're trying to have these conversations over the phone, right? And we get to the end of the job, and there's somebody that walks in and is like, well, that's not what I expected. It's like, all I could see was your face in a 2x2 box on my computer, so I didn't know you were disagreeing with what we were talking about. So I love the in-person part and how that plays in. So, Mackenzie, back to some of the things that you were talking about a second ago. You said really the critical thinking aspect and having the right experts in the room. What value does that bring to the process for you?
I think within each of the buckets, and usually I'm speaking to sustainability and siting the building and massing, and you know, I have a narrow view of where that has the greatest impact for what I'm looking at. I think pulling levers in terms of understanding what that vision is for each of my owners, because no two projects are the same. There is no real standard for quality of design. So you have to have a very good understanding of, are we talking about something that's meant to be very iconic? What kind of impact are we making in the community? From a design aspect, what do you want to do? How flexible is your master plan? How can we set you up for successes down the road for conversions? We know that happens. Renovations. We look at the upfront cost that can be there, and that's a strategy to ensure that there's cost savings later on down the road. I know Mark will tell you that mechanical is the biggest, investment that an owner will have.
Right.
The operation of the building is where we should really be focusing those cost savings. And it may come with a premium, but we have the same thing. In design, to be able to expand our buildings and change them functionally down the road 20 years from now, setting them up for successes in how they're built, their business will grow.
Absolutely. Mark, I want to come back to something you said a minute ago about when to get trade partners involved, right? We're just talking about experts, trade partners involved. I know Ed's going to have something to say here, but for you, what's the right time?
I like them to be on board at the very latest, right at the beginning of design development. But ideally, more in kind of that early schematic design level, because schematic design is still trying to get your budget right and get the scope right and all that kind of stuff. And there's not a lot on paper yet. The stakes are low in terms of the time to peel things back, or that's the time that we need to be throwing things at the wall and see what sticks.
Right.
And so multiple instances in my career where I've had great ideas from trade partners come up that wasn't even in the conversation. Mm. And those are the times you really want to explore those.
Right.
And put some numbers to it. Mm-hmm. And say, hey, you know what? We have a project that McKinsey and I are working on now where we have a budget that was earmarked for sustainability, and mm-hmm. and some of that was earmarked for the envelope. Mm-hmm. And so we got into the energy modeling phase of the project and realized, well, gosh, any more envelope improvements past a certain point is really diminishing returns. Mm. And so let's maybe move some of that bucket of money from the envelope earmark into the mechanical earmark, because the slice of the pie of the energy usage is way higher after a certain amount. Mm-hmm. You always want to maximize your what we call passive strategies. So mm-hmm. your envelope is a passive strategy, and then you go to the active strategies. And so in this particular project, we found that it was very heavily ventilation driven. It's a healthcare project, so we know that it's going to be heavily ventilation driven, and in this climate zone it's always mm-hmm. going to be heating driven.
Sure.
And so we found that energy recovery for that amount of money was a way better use of the owner's dollars than putting more insulation in the walls or on the roof. At some point it's just diminishing returns. We're fighting to try and get 1 or 2% more energy savings, which by the way is maybe $20,000 a year.
Right.
It's not that much.
Yeah. It's not going to move the needle.
Yeah.
Right?
But if you take a look at that and attack the ventilation strategy, then it's like, 40%.
Right. That's back to the stewardship component.
Exactly.
As well, right? Making sure you have the right value set. Ed, what were you going to say about trade partners and involvement?
So I agree with Mark. Generally, the earlier the better, but it does depend. It depends on the project and it depends on the trade.
Yeah, that's right.
By way of example, on a hospital, drywall is important. It's a big part of it, but mm-hmm. we might not need to bring them on early.
Right.
Conversely, the systems or the skin of the building, curtain wall, a project that I'm involved in now, a very large project, has 31 elevators. So we made the decision to bring on the elevator company in the very first package that we put out, so that the structure could be designed around the specific elevator manufacturer. So we need to look at those type of things, you know, specific to the project. But generally, the earlier the better. But yeah, no later than SD on critical systems.
Yeah.
So when we get the job, and you're looking at the OPR or whatever the document is, and you kind of see the requirements from the owner, Ed, how do you start that process to say, hey, these are the dollar amounts that we're going to try to assign to each of the different buckets that Mark was talking about here a minute ago?
Yeah, so even before we start to assign the numbers, I want to make sure that we have the right buckets, right? So I'm going back to that and how we're going to break up the project, how it's going to be designed. There might be multiple parts of the project where there's separate design teams, so we may want to break it up by those buckets. The owner may have certain financial accounting things that they need to need us to account for. So I just like to ask question after question after question and draw out more information. It's not on paper yet. Doesn't need to be on paper. We're not there yet. But the more that we just ask questions to better understand, then we can start to first establish what those buckets are, right? So as I said, we start from general and move from the outside in and get more and more detailed. So we'll look at, do we need to break this project up into three maybe major elements? And then within that, I like to use uniformat and break it down into systems. It's the way that we design, the way that we think as a builder, right? Foundations, substructure, structure, the building envelope, the building systems, then the interiors, and then take and break it down even more than that, or we do for pre-construction purposes, to CSI phase, really into the detail. And the reason for that is that if we set the target too big, the scope too big, it's not going to be very well defined and we're not going to hit it. So the more that we can refine it, by way of example, the mechanical systems, we wouldn't say the mechanical systems are going to be, $30 million. We would break it down into air handling units, right? Ductwork, building automation system controls, right? So we begin to break it down into more finite pieces like that. Even in the initial session, we'll talk about those because it's really critically important to get the buckets established so we track it right from the beginning. So it'll meet the needs of construction, design, as well as the owner.
It also provides predictability, right?
Absolutely.
As you're looking at each line item in the budget, it's really easy to look and you'll know why the electrical number went up this time or why the architectural number went up this time.
Yeah.
And you can pinpoint it, circle back to the vision and say, this was part of the vision, right? This was the one thing, the must have. We got to maintain that, right? Is it time to move some money from this bucket to that bucket to make sure it's maintained? Mackenzie, right. when we break something down like Ed was just talking about, are you always trusting of Ed and his numbers, or do you have your own historical data you'd want to look at?
Sure, no. No, we know who our experts are. No, we do trust.
Right answer.
That is the reason why we look for the right partner. Having the right expertise, the right voices in the room, that really speaks to that. You know, what you've got is strategy. And what I've learned from our contractors and our engineers as well, there's architecture has to respond to some of the most significant components of the building. Let's take mechanical. You know, if in a target value design situation you have earmarked mechanical dollars and have broken that down, and you know that one of the systems is out of line with what maybe our expectations are, we know we can do better. That's where innovation comes in. We are right. able to detect where the failures are and to improve line by line, and then follow that. Make sure that the savings are real, and perhaps, you know, there's a strategy to circumnavigate some of that by early release packages and getting those, and being able to identify which of the equipment can be bought out sooner than later, you know, to avoid escalation perhaps, or challenges in actually getting that to the site later. And then the architecture can respond to that instead of, you know, we're all just siloed and we're all just trying to do the best here. It should be a very collaborative approach.
Yeah, I like how you described how you break down the project into buckets, because it really mimics not only the design process and how we design buildings, but it also kind of groups those with experts. And so I am not an expert in envelope and shouldn't be in any of those conversations about the envelope or the building, but keeping myself in my expertise, but being able to understand what the envelope is trying to do so that I can make sure that my systems are aligned with that. And so that's 100% how I think about design and the whole process is, okay, what are we trying to get to first? And then where are the priorities? A lot of our early design conversations are all about what are the priorities of the owner? What's success look like? Mm-hmm. And so that we can define that and then measure ourselves later. And so I feel like the whole TBD process aligns to that and kind of helps us in a more natural way than just going, okay, we all go to our own separate buildings, do our thing, and then we come back at a couple different milestones and see how far we've drifted, right? You know,
so. Well, and that's value engineering, right? When things go bad, when you don't monitor it in between major milestones, things do go bad typically.
Right.
So it's that constant interaction, the iteration, the check-ins. When TVD becomes part of the vernacular of the project team, it works. When you have an engineer calling up and say, hey, Ed, what do we have in for this? What do you think about that? Mm-hmm. Right, so you're checking in all the time. Sometimes I think about it like a swimmer in a 200-meter freestyle. Right, we all dive into the pool at the same time, and then maybe take four strokes and you come up for air, and more strokes and you come up for air. Those are the check-ins. When we go to do the flip, the turn, that's a major milestone in design, and we're pricing it, right? But we don't stop swimming, and you don't stop designing. So we have to be talking all the time, right? So because it's constantly in motion, the design, which means we have to be talking all the time about the target budgets, and are we in sync? Are we hitting them?
Yeah.
I was just about to ask you that, is how often do we have to look at it, right? That was the question I just written down. Yeah. 'Cause you talked about detecting failures, Mackenzie, and that's one of the things that if maybe I'm not going to take a breath till I get to the first turn. Do you think I'm going to have some failures in my bucket allowance at the first milestone?
I think you will.
Absolutely.
You might sink.
Yeah, I might pass out. Let's be honest. I haven't swam in a long time. But I really like what you said about that. It's a really good analogy to think about. It's like you have to come up every now and then. We as contractors have to be willing to take the call, right? And as designers, y'all have to be willing to make the call or be able to provide the feedback, right? So it's all the way back to this, the right relationship, right? And having the right, the community amongst the team That comes from the in-person meetings. It comes from the conversations. It comes from the conditions of satisfaction. We love to do a conditions of satisfaction kind of charter at the beginning of every job. Help establish a vision. What does success look like? You said that just a second ago. How can we define success for this job and really make sure that when we're all done, everybody's standing here going, this is exactly what I wanted. Yeah. It's going to serve the purpose of my people. It's going to serve the purpose of the people that are going to be in this building, whatever we're looking for.
And that we want to do it again together. Together.
That's right.
Absolutely. That's one of the key items, too. That's always at the bottom on the contractor side for the conditions of satisfaction is be on the owner's good list, not be on the naughty list when the project's over. Was there anything else that y'all wanted to talk about in that? It seemed like that was a really good...
You asked about the frequency, and I would say for design team members, the frequency of check-in varies, right? But for us, it's almost daily, right? Because we're interacting with different design team members, different frequencies. So that is almost every day that we're looking at, giving feedback on a design element or a ROM number on something, right? And that's the way that it works, is that constant interaction and iteration of numbers. Now, it's a heavy lift, but it's worth doing, and that's how it works.
Well, it's fluid.
That's right.
And I think it is continuous, and it's that rhythm you're talking about with the swimmers. I think it's the same as picking up the phone. I mean, it doesn't have to be a Zoom call. It doesn't have to be something
Amen.
Structured.
Yeah, amen to that.
Hey, I just found something. We're thinking about doing this. Sure. What impact does that have on our bottom line? Is there a better way to do it? I mean, let's play 20 questions. We can get to this. We can get to the answer and check a bunch of boxes for everyone at the table.
Yeah, and even having the trade partner input as well, right? Because sometimes they might know of a different system or they might know of a different avenue to try to accomplish something that gets the right cooling load taken care of or the right heat load taken care of that helps everybody and is not even in of our realm of possibility for here. So
yeah, a lot of times we see great innovation come from just the procurement. You know, they know who's going to be the one that we can get on time or the one who's, got the better pricing out there and those sorts of things. And so we can design to that manufacturer. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest frustrations in the design community is, okay, we're designing this. We have to pick a specific something, but we are keeping it open for procurement and keep it competitive. And then, we joke in the design community, like, well, if you want to be on the job, you don't want to be listed as the specified manufacturer because guaranteed you're not going to be the one that gets used.
Right.
And so we joke about that a lot, but it's almost, the poison. And so that makes a big difference for us because, okay, now we know that XYZ manufacturer is who is going to be the best, and we've already got them locked in.
Right.
And so now we can design around that, because if we don't, then that's an RFI later. How many times have we said, okay, we've designed an air handler, we've bought a different one, and the electrical connections are slightly different?
Right.
It's every job. And so it's a risk to the job. It's a bucket that ends up being contingency and those sorts of things. But if you can mitigate that risk early on in design, we're all about it. It's just, it makes everybody's job easier and it's less waste because it takes everybody doing it twice when we do it differently. So,
right. And I think Mackenzie alluded to that earlier when you said that the values are real, right? When you think about what the value is of this specific scope and maybe something changes, you're like, oh, it's a $10,000 savings for this, but nobody ever goes back and looks at the connection.
That's right.
And all of a sudden the electrician's pulling wire up there and they're like, oh.
That's right. Yeah, the mechanical guy and in the old world, old school kind of way of doing things, hey, you buy out create your margin by, buyout and try and really get the best thing for the mechanical, and that might save $5,000 over here and cost $50,000 over here. Mm-hmm. And then everybody looks at everybody in the room and says, that's a failure. So the more that we can drive those things out, and we have to have the trade partners there because they're the ones that are in conversation with the market to be able to actually make those procurements. And sometimes they have such a great relationship with purchasing power that makes a huge difference mm-hmm. to the owner in pricing and, you know, responsiveness, all sorts of things. It's super powerful.
That is just spot on. Take air handling units for an example, right? That varies over time, which manufacturers might be more competitive, and it varies by market, it varies by region.
Yep.
And so making those selections early for that specific project, for that market, will let you get the best value. And not doing that, there are a lot of downstream effects, negative effects.
Exactly.
As you know, we mentioned, electrical can affect structure, so many different things.
Yeah, exactly.
I think back to a project that we did, I don't know, 10 years ago in Austin, and it was a design build. It was a chilling station, and it was a 15,000-ton station. It was going to be unmanned. Well, the OPR said it all needed to be air-conditioned, and we started saying, hey, why are we not going to do this? And I was talking directly to the mechanical guy, and we ended up coming back with this huge credit, and thank the Lord that the electrician was sitting in that next meeting going through the list of, hey, what are savings opportunities? And we said, we can save this much money if we don't condition the first floor. And the owner says, oh my gosh, this is such a great idea. And the electrician says, hold on, you know, my conductor size is going to have to increase, right? It's going to be warmer in the space. And all of a sudden, it's like, it's a good thing we didn't put that one on the log yet, right? It's a good thing that we didn't account for that. And all of a sudden, everybody was in the room. We could diagnose the issue right away. And the electrical engineer says, great, let me go back and I can do some calcs and figure out what the conductor size is now. And hey, it's not the savings we thought it was, but it's still worthy of looking at. So
we as designers are really good at making great ideas expensive.
Well, it's important to look at the potential unintended consequences, right?
Absolutely.
It's having that conversation, digging deep.
So when circling back on how often do we look at this, when, you know, typically we have owners that bring us on a seam at risk type project, and that's very prescriptive about, we have an estimate at 100%. SDs and 50% DDs. Right. Is there an increased drawing review or release? Would you say, Ed, is that beneficial, or is it?
Not an increased drawing release. It's really not about that, about having the design team stop and print, right? We still use the major milestones for a printing, and it's always good to do that, have a check set and really put eyes on it. But we're able to look typically in the model, right? And so we're having virtual meetings and looking at a model. We have people in, even early on, beginning BIM coordination, looking, try to identify some potential clashes or problems. So it doesn't have to be the physical print to stop and print. And that's kind of a killer for a design team, right? That's a big task.
Yeah, it can be a lot of effort. And if it's not being, if it's not helping the project move forward, then, you know, I think on big projects, it makes sense to have maybe a, you know, 50% DD and DD and then 50% CD and CD. But on smaller projects where we're doing that, and then in 3 weeks, we're doing the 100%.
Yeah. No sense in doing that, right?
There's really not enough time to actually react to it and help steer the ship. And so I think sometimes we can just get programmed into checking boxes and not really think about the value of it.
The contract says we have to do this, so we're going to do it, right?
That's exactly right.
So Ed talked about looking in the model. How do y'all feel about, you know, sharing models throughout design and letting guys like us look through them and try to determine quantities, that kind of stuff?
I think, you know, having the conversations early so that we know how to set up the model and those sorts of things and expectations, and make sure that it aligns with the contract, because sometimes we've been asked for a lot of stuff that's, you know, significant amount of time.
Sure.
But in general, I would say, you know, I don't think there's a project I've done in this method that we haven't laid out the electrical rooms and send those to the electrician and said, please take a look at these and tweak them, because now's the time to do it. Super easy. And they're going to come up with things that we just don't think about, how the conduit bends into this and that and the other. And they come up with a superior deal. And then so essentially, by the time you're at CDs, you have an as-built document, because they're going to build off of it that way. That's that's the goal. And I think we welcome that input. And you know, a lot of times we're pretty good about having those conversations to say, hey, just so you know, we're in iteration mode. Don't worry about what's in the model the next few weeks because we're playing with some things.
Right.
Yep. You know, and that's always gone very well. They're like, okay, you know, we're not going to send you 25 questions on Tuesday right. morning because you saw us playing around in the model. So we do a pretty good job of saying, hey, we're going to be playing around here. And then, hey, we're ready for you guys to really take a look at this and give us some ideas. So
I was going to say the same thing. The only danger there is, and it goes back to relationship, what's the expectation when we stop, drop, and print? It's usually for our process prints. It's for coordination. And we're good at knowing that there's probably two or three design iterations in there that we're either testing or considering still. And so handing that over could be confusing. It's misinformation
right.
in some mm-hmm. cases. It's not a very clean model for a lot of the first initial design phases. So we do that. We welcome that, certainly. I think it needs to be a controlled effort. I think it's a more of a coordination tool, and it deserves conversation.
Agreed.
Yeah, and I think what goes along with that, too, is things just in, it's all about communication again, where, hey, we talked about this 2 weeks ago. How come it's not updated yet? Well, we're not working on that part of the project right now. We're kind of doing these other things. And what I love about the TVD, the early design phase, is a lot of it is just spending time studying things and going,
yeah.
hey, let's run this idea to ground. Let's run this idea to ground. Let's put an ROI to all of this stuff. And it really gives us tons of experience that you wouldn't get until the building was built otherwise. And so we're getting to really spitball this thing out a little bit further with quick. I mean, we're not holding anybody to any dollars. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just doing comparative dollars so mm-hmm. we can say, right. oh, is this a payback or is it not a payback? And that's what I love about it, is you really can test a lot of things quickly, and within a week or so, you know, you've got the answers and say, okay, yeah, we're not exploring that. And sometimes that can take, it can linger months if you're not got everybody in sync and having weekly check-ins, and you have that other person who's responsible for that component engaged and there at the table.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Yeah, I love that. And we love playing the what ifs, right? To do it early, what ifs, and then run yeah. ROM numbers or that's rough right. order of magnitude to test out different solutions and to do it early.
Yeah.
I'd really then set the course. Something else that we like to do as part of target value design and pre-construction are charrettes, in-person charrettes, where we have very focused meetings where you're focused on a certain issue or set of issues and work for solutions, right? So we have done it on the large project that I mentioned. We've had 10 for the building facade. And then ultimately we rolled in superstructure, so we called it the building facade and superstructure charrette. And we had everybody in a room literally working through details even before the shop drawings had started and before design was complete. And it's such a positive way to do it, to have those focused charrettes. We've also done it on MPE systems, right? So you're working out a lot of potential issues, I should say, not necessarily issues, but potential issues. And we just find it's a very positive way to do it. Those, I think, are better in person. Get people gathered up in a room so the yeah. frequency is less,
yeah. mm-hmm.
Less often, but very, very powerful tool.
But you're kind of solving those problems before they become problems.
That's right. Right.
That's
right.
The idea.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
Awareness. I would say some of our charrettes, and we use the same word. I think just making sure everyone's on the same page for floor to floor heights. No fly zones.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
The,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of savings, heights. Right, to be had. Yeah. And depending on the function of each floor, there's some play there that could be potential cost savings, major cost yes. savings. So some of those kinds of charrettes with all of the folks who would have buy-in on the building structure and the building systems need to be present to help guide that conversation. We don't do that in a silo. So those are the kinds of things I think I heard when you're talking about, you know, that kind of collaboration.
One of the things, Mark, you said a few minutes ago was TVD gives you the opportunity to drive waste out. And I want to talk about that for a little bit. When you said drive waste out, there was 100 things that went through my mind about what that actually means. Let's dive into that a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah. Waste in my mind is time. Mm-hmm. That's probably the biggest one. Mm-hmm. Things like, okay, we made a decision, but now we have to go back and make a decision again. So you're kind of double dipping there. Sometimes you end up buying more or less than you need to. And that's pretty common for us as well. Just the unknowns. I think a lot of times as an engineer, you're kind of forced into, well, what's worst case? Right. Okay. And then if those decisions aren't made at the right time, then that just carries further and further and further through. And then before you know it, you've got systems that are oversized or those sorts of things for the what if scenario. And we haven't really driven out some of that. And then as a result, we carry too much money in that bucket that could have saved some other features for the project that we really wanted but had to concede on. So in my mind, that's what comes in my mind, or what I mean when I say waste. It's most of the time it's time and just redoing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's actually in the material at the end.
Right. You know, yeah. What very real construction with? Cost. You're right. Yeah. That's dead on. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think that waste could be labor in that time. I see it as labor, just doing something twice, three times. Mm-hmm. I think that actually increases the chance for errors and omissions. Mm-hmm. As a designer, 100%. Think you've already figured that out. You think you've already coordinated that thing. Well, the downstream effects of unintended consequences come back to bite. It comes from a little bit of fatigue, having been through it. And certainly we're very well versed in doing that, but there is some risk there that we have to constantly be aware of.
You bring up a great point, Mackenzie. My good friend Sarah, that you and I were talking about earlier, she did a study for us, and this is probably like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And where do we make the most mistakes on projects? And it was astounding to see that if we're drawing things and then changing and redrawing things and changing and redrawing things, that is where we make mistakes. And it's also out of order sometimes too. So if you are doing things that you did in schematic design, but you're doing it back in construction documents well down the road, Mackenzie brought up that point. It's excellent. That's your brain has already moved past that.
Right.
It's out of order. It's out of sequence. And so you don't go through the same thinking process.
Right. It's already been vetted, right?
That's right.
Right.
And so an example, one time, you know, hey, just move this. You know, how many times have we said that to each other?
Right.
It's just this. Yeah. And so you go to whoever's actually doing that work and say, it's just this, do this. And they're just myopically focused on, okay, I'm just doing that. I check that task off, move on. And nobody steps back and goes, wait a second, this starts to domino other things. That was the correlation on that, and drawing things too much is definitely one of the biggest risks for designers, is that's the reason why we make mistakes in almost every case. Conceptually, we're almost always nailed down. We're fine conceptually. Mm-hmm. It's those little details that we did it right when we drew it in DD, you know, because I spend a lot of my time going, how did we make this mistake?
Right.
And I go back through our documentation, and we do a pretty good job of documenting that. And almost always we can uncover the, oh, and then you go talk to that person and the light bulb is, oh gosh, I just handed that off to so-and-so and gave them this direction.
And they just moved it. Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right. And then it's, oh my, look at how much money that cost everybody in the end, because we just moved something and we didn't actually go through the full thinking process that we did when we placed it the first time.
Mark, I think there's another place where TBD drives out waste, and that's when we get to construction, and it has to do with RFIs, right? I mean, that can be a big time-consuming process. Yeah. And I find that when we use TBD and do it right, that we have fewer and less significant RFIs and fewer change orders, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're solving so much together up front.
Yeah. Yeah, it a lot of RFIs is, I don't understand what we're trying to do here. Let's sort this out. And those are, you know, important RFIs, but we've already got that covered if we're shoulder to shoulder in DD.
That's one of the big benefits early on for owners, also designers and the contractors. You have those conversations when it is just paper, or it is just in the model, it's easy to move something. It's not we're building something and we're just going to slide this over a little bit and you end up in a big problem. But I mean, RFIs, they're tough for us at being assigned to a job site right now. And we've got RFIs and, you know, the designer's like, oh my gosh, you keep asking us questions. And we're like, we're still trying to figure out what we're doing, right? It was a rushed process. And I love thinking about TVD and how it relates to accountability for everybody. It's no longer just on the designer. It's no longer just on the owner. It's no longer just on us. It's, hey, we're a team. We're going to get in the boat together and let's paddle this way and let's make sure that we can make the right decisions. What you said earlier about designing a system for worst case scenario, and all of a sudden the building opens and the building manager calls and says, this is the least efficient building I've ever had in my life. Why is our electric bill so much? And you're like, well, we designed a worst case and we never circled back. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever came back and said, is this the right way to do it? So I love the thought of being even all in the pool at the same time, swimming the same 200 meters, and we're getting to the turn at the same time, and we're all going to break Michael Phelps' record right at the end.
I think it's a great way to hold each other accountable, right? I think when everybody has skin in the game, everybody buys into it, then it's easier to, I won't say call each other out, but ask questions, right? Challenge each other in a very constructive way. A very positive way to do it.
I think, you know, when I first started in the industry 26 years ago.
Last century?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Technically, yes. There was some ego involved, and I, at least from my chair, I observed it. You know, if you were a good engineer, you kind of had some swagger to you and those sorts of things. And ego is an obstacle to most things in all reality. And so, and no more is it more true than in the construction trailer and in the design meetings. And so, you know, target value delivery kind of crushes that. And I think it's a good thing. Nobody has this, hey, it's my way or the highway kind of thing. It's my specification. Nobody mess with it. It's really, it drives that out very quickly. And, I've found myself gravitating to those preferred partners that, carry that same kind of thinking. Hey, you know, check your ego at the door. It has no place here. So,
well, it's an opportunity for everybody to learn also.
Yeah.
Right. And we talked about that at lunch today, talking about how COVID has played an impact on people just being able to meet in person and overhear conversations and learn. But if everybody's in the same room and the egos are checked at the door, it's an excellent opportunity for everybody to get smarter, and only everybody can benefit if we're all smarter, right?
Yeah. I mean, how are we not going to do something awesome with this brain power in the room? As long as somebody doesn't come in there with a black cape and start waving it around and you end up, you know, subjugating to whatever that person says rather than, hey, I think differently and I want to have a voice here too. That's how we get the best projects.
Yeah, and I think we all genuinely want to help each other, and TVD opens that up, right? Yeah, so we're not only holding each other accountable, but we're really helping each other so we all are successful.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. Accountability at every level only helps everybody, right?
That's right.
Good at communication. Were you going to say something about that a second ago?
Oh, I was nodding. I like all the things. I would say my abilities as an architect are directly proportionate to the amount of input and leadership and education and mentorship I have received from contracting relationships with contractors and my engineers. Mm-hmm. Those are the best partners. Those are the best projects. And I think that my ability to coordinate a building comes from the understanding of how to put a building together for constructability and code, certainly. But outside my own discipline, are a lot, it's a vast amount of knowledge on every project that I can never know. So even 22 years in, I'm still learning. Mm-hmm. And if you've got the right partners.
And it keeps changing. You're never that's bored right. in this industry. If you are, you're doing it wrong.
Right.
For sure. Because it's ever evolving. What was every day, this is how you do something 5 years ago, it is not true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Changes so quickly.
Yeah, it does.
The codes change, right? Materials mm-hmm. change. Yeah. Equipment changes.
Yeah. Construction methods change. You know, how equipment that you can acquire is different. You know, it's actually a really exciting time. You know, codes a lot of times will drive the need for innovation and very true here in Denver, Colorado, where they've set Energize Denver and they're pushing building owners to operate at a energy use intensity level that is a very high bar. And so that is not only driving innovation from a design perspective, but it absolutely drives the manufacturers mm-hmm. of the technologies that you need available to you to be able to attain those goals. And so it's a very exciting time right now in that regard, because things that we're applying to a project that McKinsey and I are working on right now didn't even exist 5 years ago. And so in 5 years, we're going to be applying something completely different. And so, you know, McKinsey referenced, you know, trying to future-proof buildings, and
right.
no more important is that than now, really, because things are changing so quickly. How people use buildings and the technology, and how's the AI going to change that, and how's autonomous vehicles going to change it? Things like a parking garage might end up needing to be clinical space at some point, mm-hmm. or it's throwaway waste. And so, you know, instead of putting that in a landfill, let's figure out how that's supposed to look in 10, 15 years. That's the stuff that's exciting to me right now.
One of the things, McKinsey, you said a few minutes ago was about removing the necessity for VE. Yeah. I wanted to circle back to that, and I wanted to dive into that a little bit and see, when you said that, like, I could see like the twinkle in your eye that is that you're super passionate about it. So tell us a little bit about removing that necessity for
removing VE. I think it's commonplace to start to talk about value engineering as its own phase, like it deserves a place in our projects.
Mm.
And we always fear it, because we know that it will deplete the outcomes. It will deplete our design. It's not what we sold as our quality of work. And we know from experience that it also means that the building that was planned is not going to function the way it was intended. And, you know, for everybody involved, it doesn't have that gold standard of success attached to it. There was some failure. And we did what we could with the time that was left, and it came in at the last minute, and it feels like a scramble, and it just doesn't have to be that way. I don't think we have to make those accommodations.
Completely agree. I stopped using the term years ago, because as Mark said, it doesn't add value, and it's not engineering, right? And it's planning for failure, right? Planning to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so I stopped doing it. Let's plan for success. Let's use the tools that we have available. Let's collaborate, you know, and we end up with a much better product, much happier owner, much better overall experience. But I don't even use VE anymore as a term in our vernacular.
It also ended up being a number that was thrown out there that was not well-defined a lot of times. And so then are we realizing all the savings that we were supposed to? And maybe it's two or three iterations until we get that right.
Right.
And sometimes it was a fictitious number because they didn't know ABC when they came up with that number. And so oftentimes those meetings are so brief in terms of the decision making. It's a number on a spreadsheet to get down to another bottom line number, and nobody really knows the entire impact of those decisions because oftentimes they were, okay, electrician, you give me this. Mechanical, you give me this. Nobody talks. We all just put it in a list, and then we go, okay, here's the numbers, yay or nay. Right. And that's exactly how those conversations happen. And then in the end, we're like, well, yeah, it saved the electrician $50,000, but it just cost the mechanical, you know, $100,000 or stuff like that. So you're not actually, in reality, you're not actually getting anywhere. Yep.
The next pricing update comes in and you're like,
yep,
why didn't we save $50,000 here? Right. What happened? That's,
and we did everything on that VE list and magically something's not off.
And so we're back to redesign or putting things in that we just took out, right? It's the downstream impact and those unintended consequences.
Yeah. And still the end date stays the same. And so we've got to redesign it all now. You know, I had a project that years ago we, you know, incorporated all of the value engineering items on it. And at 50% CDs, the decision was made to eliminate an entire air system, and this is in a hospital, and so had to redesign everything at 50% CDs, and it was a complete nightmare, you know. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, I don't feel like that was value. Now, I would have been glad to do that at the DD phase, right, when it should have had that conversation, and that would have been a natural iterative process that is what design is. But boy, when you do it too late, then it just causes so much problems. And, you know,
I've seen owners start asking what it was you get awarded a job, right? A lot of times we get awarded jobs at 100% DD, same at risk works, what Flenco does. And I've seen owners, sophisticated owners, ask, what was your DD number? And then what was the final contract?
Yeah.
And looking for a percentage point. And if that percentage point is 5% lower, they're like, you guys didn't do your job during the estimating phase or during the pre-con phase. And it's, I got asked that question in an interview a couple months ago, and I was kind of like, I'm glad we were within 1%, because that would have been pretty embarrassing to say, oh yeah, we gave back 5% to the owner, and they're sitting there going, well, what did you cut out of that job? Mm-hmm. What are you going to cut out of our job if that doesn't come around?
Yep.
Ed, how is the percentage point when you think about close percentage at DDs and at final contract on the really the project you're working on right now, is 1% kind of a big margin, or is it little? Or
it is. We're within 0.25%. Wow. We've been able to keep it there through through COVID and through a lot of escalation, and it's just by working as a team, right? Keep hitting those targets, making adjustments, not cheapening the project, but we've been able to hit it. Because the team is committed to it, because we talk about it in literally every meeting. And we're committed to it. We've stayed within 0.25%.
That's planning for success, right?
That's right.
Probably music to the owner's ears, right? Hopefully the owner's listening today are saying, golly, this sounds like a great team, right? Yeah. Where are they at? Oh, they're in Denver. Cool. We can find them to do a job for us. So, I mean, that's definitely the whole point of today, is to really talk about what the value is, the overall value for really the owner and then also the team, right? And we end up getting to the end of a project, we're proud of how it turned out. We're happy that we hit the budget line. We hit the completion date like everybody thought. And we walk out going, hey, we can do another job together. The owner, there's a chance the owner's going to hire us again, right? Yeah. It's going to be successful.
Absolutely.
So at Flenco, we're really big on safety, right? And we were talking about this curse word, VE. I'm not even going to say it now after what we've talked about it. When we think about safety, how does that process impact safety on a project?
Yeah, from a design perspective, we think about safety in operations specifically. And, you know, if you design too much equipment in too small of a room, then that's an unsafe place to do the work, and oftentimes poorly maintained and those sorts of things.
Right.
Sometimes we make decisions early in the design process on the electrical side that have high impacts to arc flash and those sorts of things that are major safety components. And so I think weaving safety into the design process is an important conversation as well to really drive that out and make it not only a beautiful, fully functional building, but it can actually be maintained and can maintain its high performance at the end.
Edward, do you have something to add there?
I do. So part of the target value design and pre-construction process are the charrettes that I talked about. And the charrettes, we focus on safety. By way of example, when we were working on the facade, the decision was made to use unitized curtain wall. And we looked at how that could be installed more safely than stick built. On the facade of the building, we have ACM metal panels that would go on a light gauge metal framing, but we determined that we could do that in the shop, right? It could be gusseted and installed, so we don't have someone on the side of the building installing all these small pieces of light gauge metal framing. It can be done quicker, you know, more safely. It's doing being done in a fabrication shop. So we look at that, the installation of equipment, right? You mentioned arc flashing, but we look at the installation of equipment, the space that we have. If something could be changed, it can be installed more safely. Prefabrication, right? So that we're doing more offsite fabrication and bringing it in, doing less work at height. So it's a really big focus for us, during those charrettes and throughout the design process.
Absolutely. Mackenzie, do you have anything to add?
I've got to look through my lens of life safety. Okay. I think if you're talking about value engineering, and this is pretty drastic, but it does happen, where we're actually charged with reducing square footage for cost mitigation. Well, the life safety plans are designed in egress, for instance, in ratings, in how to defend in place. That strategy is designed early on, in as early as SD. And if in later stages we're actually removing portions of the building or reducing square footage, that has to be redone completely across the entire floor and vertically to ensure that egress has not been disturbed. Sometimes we're asked to downgrade in terms of ratings, and that complicates everything. So I think if, you know, we're really trying to make huge strides in cost reduction and we're reducing scope, you're actually at risk of missing something that's really a non-negotiable and should remain in place.
Who would have ever thought TVD could impact safety? But it turns out it does. Are there closing thoughts, Mark? Any closing thoughts on TVD and what you want to leave the listeners with?
Oh boy,
y'all be thinking. I'm going to ask y'all too. So Mackenzie and Ed, y'all are on deck.
We covered a lot of. Hey, I can't do that, can I?
No.
We covered a lot of great stuff here. So I guess in summary, I would say that if your project's not doing that, or if you're not setting up your contracts to execute a project like that, I'd highly encourage you to try it. I've found it to be a superior way to execute projects and to execute work. And I think it gives you the granular decision-making that's required for complex projects for sure. And, it breaks down those silos between, you know, the different swim lanes. You know, you're a mechanical engineer, so you're only going to talk about this with these people, and we're getting to use the best talents of everybody in the room when we do that. So I'm all for it. So
Mackenzie, what about you?
I think what we're just talking about is culture. It's a culture shift. It's the design and engineering and construction team's culture of how we deliver work. And it all starts with the RFP. I think that is a big change. I think that we need to start to see planning for and asking for and expecting target value design as the place to start, the place to jump off, and to make sure that you've got the right partners that can actually deliver on that promise. That's
way better than ditto.
Way
was
better.
Was it way better than what you said, though?
She's so competitive. I love it. No, definitely not.
I love what you said about it starting. I love what you said about it starting at the RFP, because when you hear this, you say, hey, this is a more concerted pre-construction effort from everybody's perspective.
Yeah.
But the pre-construction cost is peanuts compared to where you're going to end up on the tail end, right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Brother Ed, what do you have?
Commit to the process. And what that really means is commit to the people, commit to your partners and live it. It works. It's not always easy, but it works and it's fun. You'll get success, but commit to the process, commit to the people and work it.
Awesome. Thank you all so much for being here today. It was great to hang out. Great to talk. And hopefully our listeners are enlightened by what we had to say today. So Thanks for coming out. Looking forward to the next job with you all.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You
thanks
bet.
Fun. Yeah. Thanks, man. It's been such a long